The stream is not live.
Madam Chair, we are live and recording, and you may gavel in the meeting when ready.
Thank you. Good morning. The open session for this Wednesday, April 19th is in order. Before we dive into our agenda, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge and congratulate all of our staff at the FEC on receiving the Most Improved Small Agency Award from the Partnership for Public Service. Our engagement score increased by 4.8 points from last year, and we were ranked in the top half of small agencies for teamwork and customer service. So thank you to the incredible staff for doing the work and for continuing to make this agency a better place. Now on to our agenda. There is a special motion. Mr. Vice Chair.
Good morning. I move that the commission consider press office acknowledgement of complaints and that the commission determine pursuant to 11 CFR section 2.7 D1 that business so requires and no earlier public announcement was possible. I further move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the commission may consider the late submission of agenda documents number 23-07-A and 23-08-A.
Any discussion of the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. The first matter on the agenda is the draft advisory opinion 2023-01 in response to an advisory opinion request from U.S. Representative Nanette Berrigan. And her on her behalf, we have Brian Svoboda and Antoinette Floto. On behalf of OGC, we have Sarah Peck presenting. Ms. Peck, welcome to the dais. Mr. Svoboda and Ms. Floto, come on up. And I'll remind everyone to keep the microphone close to you. The sign down there. And with that, Ms. Peck, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 23-01-A is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by U.S. Representative Nanette Diaz-Barragan. Representative Barragan asks whether, as chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, she may use campaign funds to pay the travel expenses for certain individuals to attend official caucus events. In particular, for caucus members and other individuals who will serve as speakers or headliners at the official events and for staff facilitating those events. The draft concludes that the proposed use of campaign funds for these travel expenses is permissible under the Act and Commission regulations because the expenses are ordinary and necessary expenses incurred in connection with the requester's duties as a federal office holder. Concerning the request, the Commission received a letter from U.S. Representative Brian Steele, the chairman of the House Administrative Committee, a response to the letter from the requester, and then a second letter from Representative Steele responding to the requester's response. The letters are available on the Commission's website. The Commission received no comments on the draft. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Dickerson.
Thank you, and welcome, Council. Welcome to the dais, as the chair mentioned. So, let me first ask, there was some correspondence from the chairman of the House Committee, the Committee on House Administration last night. Did you receive it, Council?
I did, Commissioner.
Let me just as a just basic fairness, do you have anything you'd like to say in response to that letter?
Well, I've reviewed the letter and I don't think it's consistent or I don't think it's inconsistent at all with draft A before the commission. I think footnote one of draft A completely addresses his concerns, at least as to the matters before the commission's jurisdiction. And I discern nothing from my read of the letter that indicates any contrary view as to whether the proposal is inconsistent with the Act or commission regulations.
Well, let me back up, if I may. I mean, as you well know, these questions about personal use of campaign funds have come to dominate our advisory opinion process of the last year or so. I read your request, and I'm struck by the force of the advisory opinions that you cited to us. You know, to the extent that paying for foreign language courses is protected. That's a pretty strong precedent in your favor. But I have concerns, and I've expressed them in other contexts as well about the ways in which the commission, inch by inch and over decades and almost imperceptibly has drifted away from the underlying statutory text in some of our advisory opinions. So you know, recognizing again the force of the precedent you've brought to us, you know, I have some concerns about going further. And so since I have you as an interlocutor, I had a couple questions. You know, it's hard enough to apply the irrespective test in the context of candidates. But at least in the context of candidates, you know, we institutionally have a certain level of expertise. You know, there's a range of type and depth of campaign experience up here, but the commission as a whole has, you know, significant campaign experience, but none of us have held office. And, you know, incumbents, I think, are in a somewhat different position for some practical reasons. You know, they have access to resources the challengers do not. You know, they hold office, the possibilities of quid pro quo arrangements is arguably higher. So I think, you know, this is an area where the risk of corruption is higher and the First Amendment interests are lower than may be the case in other things we routinely deal with. Mm-hmm. And I think it's especially difficult because, you know, your request talks about office holder activity. And I recognize the commission has not been especially careful on this either, but the statute doesn't talk about activity by office holders. It talks about, and I'm quoting, an individual's duties as a holder of federal office. Mm-hmm. So my first question is, you know, it seems to me that the term duty implies something mandatory, you know, an action that's inherent in the office, tied to the responsibilities of the office itself, not necessarily voluntary or collateral activity of being in office. So my first question to you is, you know, do you see a distinction between an individual's duties as a holder of federal office and office holders' activities more generally?
Well, I think the duties commit to the member some measure of discretion how to fulfill the position that they hold by virtue of their election and by virtue of Article One. And I think it necessarily presupposes some discretion on the part of the member in how to most fully live that role as an office holder. So if you look, for example, at the House Ethics Manual and how the House Ethics Manual discusses the same issue of personal use, in particular, the use of campaign funds. And I'm talking here strictly from an ethics context. I realize as Topeka, it's apples and oranges. But in the ethics context, they accentuate that members generally have wide discretion to use campaign funds to perform their official and representational duties. So the manual will give examples of where the committee would view those uses of funds as being permissible, like, for example, holding a special event on the occasion of a staff member's departure or on the occasion of a special event involving a staffer, or like, for example, the purchase of commemorative gifts to give to constituents who come to the office. But these examples are not presented as being exclusive. They're being presented as being within sort of a, this is my phrase, not the committee's phrase, but a zone of reasonableness, if you will, where there's a clear enough nexus, a sufficient enough nexus to what a member ordinarily does, that the use of campaign funds is permissible in that context. And so how do you guard from the front? And it echoes in a way, again, realizing we're talking about apples and oranges, the discretion that the Act generally provides with respect to the use of campaigns. It provides that campaign funds, it provides that campaign funds may be used for any lawful purpose other than personal use, and then prescribes what personal use is. So to avoid the risk of corruption, what are the bulwarks that help keep that risk from becoming reality? One, in this particular context, actually is the ethics enforcement context. The quickest way for a member to get into trouble over personal use of campaign funds in the House of Representatives is for someone to file a complaint with the House Ethics Committee, as recent rule changes in the House is now going to make it easier to happen, or to file a complaint with the Office of Congressional Ethics. Members have a greater incentive now than they did 15 years ago, 30 years ago, to look closely on the balls and strikes of their particular spending. So that's one bulwark. And the second bulwark is, in fact, the disclosure that members make of these expenses on their reports, where they're asked about them, and they have to be able to articulate in a reasonable way what they were for. A third bulwark actually comes out of the House Ethics Rules, which is the requirement that members not only must avoid personal use, but must maintain documents sufficient to show the bona fide campaign or political purpose of the expense incurred. So, as was the case, for example, with Congressman Bud Schuster and his ethics investigation, the Ethics Committee did not make an actual finding of personal use in that case, but held that the failure to maintain documentation created a sufficient appearance of personal use that it was subject to discipline under House rules. So I think the answer in the end, Commissioner, is we are in the one zone of activity when we're talking about incumbent members of Congress and incumbent members of the House of Representatives in particular, where the practical and legal structures provide higher levels of protection than you see in other contexts.
I'm sure. No, I appreciate that because that gets to my concern, which is, you know, how do we articulate for ourselves a standard of what is and is not a duty of a member of Congress? You're absolutely right, of course. You know, the Constitution gives Congress essentially unlimited authority to set its own rules and procedures. That's an independent grant that's unreviewable. Part of my discomfort comes from the fact that we're sitting here in an agency of the executive branch of the government, passing upon the duties of members of another branch of the government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess my question is, what do we do if there, well, let's take the easy answer first. And I think you've already answered it. You know, if there's definitive guidance from the Congress that particular action is a duty of a member, I'll ask it. I mean, I would think we would defer to that, but do you disagree?
No, I don't disagree. And I think, you know, going further, I think the history of interpretation in the House, at least, gives members some measure of discretion to determine how they best fulfill their duties. Now, they put guardrails around that. It's why they have an ethics committee. It's why they have ethics rules. And it's why these rules can be strict. But it occurs in a context where I think, in part for the reason you described, Commissioner, whether it's the separation of powers concern or just the powers inherent to the office, that you wouldn't read duties in the FECA personal use restriction to mean it helps you vote, it helps you attend committee meetings, and beyond that, it doesn't let you do anything.
But what about the inverse? I mean, so if Congress has said, no, your duties are to vote, to attend meetings, to travel as a member of an eligible congressional member organization, let's say Congress has explicitly blessed it. Easy question. What if Congress has said no? And what if there's some guidance that no, the Congress has determined that X or Y is not in fact a duty of the office? You know, we haven't, as you pointed out in your response, you know, we have an obligation under the Act to give an answer in advisory opinions where we can, provided they're not too hypothetical. Mm. And, you know, how should the Commission think about situations where the Congress may disagree with us on the understanding of a duty?
Well, I think you still have to approach the personal use question from a two-step analysis, which is you do have to start, however vague it may be, you still have to start with the irrespective test, and you have to ask, would this expense exist irrespective of the individual status as a candidate or a member of Congress? So you have that standard first, and then buttressing that almost as an exclamation point is that specific allowance allowing for the incurrence of ordinary and necessary expenses, you know, in support of the member's duties as a holder of federal office. So, I mean, I think in this case, for example, where the requester is asking, you know, while wearing their member hat, you know, with the support that can be provided, you know, by, you know, their member office, you know, under the auspices of the House of Representatives to hold events that meet with constituents and discuss policy issues with no other indicia of political activity or personal activity or things not having to do with their status as a member of Congress. In that case, the irrespective test, even before one got to the specific allowance for duties of a federal office holder, would make the expense permissible.
But I think, you know, respectfully, I think that's a little bit circular in that the irrespective test is tied again to the an expense or obligation, et cetera, that exists irrespective of one's duties as an office of an office holder.
Right.
So we still need to have a definition of duties to do the irrespective analysis.
Right.
So let me ask us the direct question. So I understand that this is not your view of the House Administration Committee's letter, but if it were the case that there were some definitive rule of the House that a member cannot use campaign funds for travel, would you agree that the commission should not bless? Should we undertake essentially our own analysis at that point, or do we defer to Congress's prohibition?
I think you would let Congress enforce its own prohibition in that case. And again, I'm speaking strictly hypothetically here.
I understand that.
We emphatically believe that the conduct we're proposing complies with House rules. We've taken steps to comply with House rules. So I wish to give no ambiguity on that point. But in a case where hypothetically there was doubt as to whether an expense complied with House rules, just for example, as whether it would comply with IRS rules. Or for example, I think there was a MER involving a candidate for governor of Alabama where it was proposed, I think it was the Arthur Davis MER, where he would propose to transfer federal campaign finance funds to a campaign for state office. It was contended that the condition that the transfer would violate Georgia law and hence would fall outside the allowance for, you know, lawful contributions to candidates for state or local office. The commission in the MER addressing that matter concluded that we don't mean in the application of the FICA standards to port in the laws of the other jurisdictions that may have other dogs in the fight. In other words, we are not going to independently evaluate whether this complies with Georgia law, just as we're not going to independently evaluate whether a transfer to a charity is going to, you know, whether the charity really is or isn't a qualified 501c. We're going to limit our application, you know, the statute requires us, you know, to limit it to, you know, the application of the act.
No, I understand that. I take no ambiguity in your position. I'm asking larger structural questions because I have to worry about where this is going.
No, true.
Okay, that's helpful. I mean, I will say I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the concept of the FEC. Congress sets our jurisdiction. Congress said, you know, personal use is prohibited, and that personal use includes expenses that would not exist but for the duties of, you know, the office. It seems to me that if Congress then definitively states what those duties are, that up or down, whether it's blessed or whether it's prohibited, that the, you know, as a member of a co-equal branch, we have an obligation to deference to that decision. And you may agree or disagree. But the last question I have is sort of related to this correspondence with the Committee on House Administration. Well, first, just a straight legal question. Do you agree with the letter's assertion that Representative Barragán will have to obtain essentially pre-clearance from the committee in order to determine whether this is an official expense?
There's not a formal process in the House by which that occurs. I take the letter to mean that the committee asserts jurisdiction over this activities and that a committee would expect a member to consult with the committee over an issue that the committee believed was in its jurisdiction. And Congresswoman Barragán's indicated that she wishes to do that. So it's a little, I think perhaps the one practical element of this process, you know, particularly with regard to a committee of the House besides the Ethics Committee, is there's not actually a clear formal process in the campaign, in the use of campaign funds context by which this occurs, right? I mean, so in a committee like House Administration, you don't have a nonpartisan professional staff as you do with the Ethics Committee. You've got a majority staff and a minority staff. The norm in the House, I think, on either side of the aisle is for members to talk to the staff, you know, in their caucus, you know, who is most familiar with the rules and get a sense of where the committee is likely to come, you know, on this. But that's a process that we have no difficulty with. And we respect, you know, Mr. Stiles' desire, you know, that we seek to comply with CHA regulations.
Well, and I spoke imprecisely. You're exactly correct that this is not a correspondence from the committee. It's correspondence from the chairman of the committee. And I didn't mean to be imprecise in that. So it's all just tying it all up. I mean, what my concern, which I'd welcome your guidance on, is that, you know, if it is true that an independent executive branch agency owes deference to Congress in Congress's description of its own duties, and if there is some possibility, and maybe the strength of the possibility matters, but if there's some risk that we will declare something an official duty of a member of the Congress and then be countermanded by the Congress itself, I'm nervous about putting people on the horns of that dilemma in no small part because, of course, the function of an advisory opinion is to immunize under the Act the requested activity. So does that potential inter-branch conflict concern you? And I guess I'm asking you to give me some comfort on this draft that we're not walking into that kind of a structural problem.
I think footnote one in draft A, which is consistent with the commission's historical approach on these questions, gives that comfort fully. I think it tells us, and I think it tells all others reading it loudly and clearly, that you express no view, positively or negatively, about how House rules impact this question, that I could not derive from footnote one or from the draft a conclusion by the commission that I could then shop to some other entity in the House and say, but it must be in connection with my duties because the Federal Election Commission said it so. I think in footnote one, you say quite clearly the opposite, and that's consistent with how the commission has addressed these same sorts of multi-jurisdictional questions with the ethics committees, but also with the IRS or with state campaign finance authorities before. So that's the comfort, I think, that we didn't propose that comfort. It was the Office of General Counsel that gave that comfort, and I think here appropriately so.
Well, and maybe this is a question for the Office of General Counsel then. In the event that a draft is adopted, and, you know, not to skip to the end, but I think the odds are pretty good, where does that leave us if, in a future advisory opinion request, it comes to pass that the Congress has spoken on this question of whether this sort of travels within official duties? I mean, if we've blessed it here and the advisory opinion's out there and, you know, the statute provides certain protections as a result of that, are we entitled to change course in light of congressional action, or are we kind of stuck with what we've done here?
I think that it would be very fact dependent. And I think that then we would look at, okay, is this a hypothetical question? Because Congress has said this activity is not permitted. We operate under a general assumption that requesters don't take illegal or unauthorized activities. And so then we ask, you know, is this even appropriate for an advisory opinion request? Because is this really a general question of the law or hypothetical because they can't actually undertake that activity?
Let me ask a related question then. Assume there's an enforcement action. You know, we have a MER and we have to vote on it. And the allegations are that, and obviously I'm asking hypotheticals to see where this is going. I'm not in any way asserting those are the facts here. But, you know, the allegations are something like, you know, let's use childcare because it's unrelated. You've got a series of advisory opinions, FEC, that bless the use of campaign funds for childcare in connection, including with certain sorts of official duties. But the Congress has subsequently changed its rules on, you know, what qualifies as an official duty within the Congress's opinion. Is the respondent in that MER still immunized by these advisory opinions, or does the change in the underlying law from the point of view of Congress represent a material change in the law that would authorize enforcement.
Commissioner, thank you for that question. I believe we would have to think about that and not not prepared to answer that question here at the table today.
I'm always happy to have raised a hard question. And Madam Chair, I appreciate your indulgence. My thanks to Council, both for the requester and OGC. I'm going to support the draft, which I didn't necessarily show up today planning to do, but I think my concerns are on the record.
Well, thank you for that engaging discussion. Colleagues, any further discussion or questions? Wonderful. With that, any motions? Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to draft advisory opinion request 2023-01, I move approval of agenda document number 23-07-A, which is draft A.
Any discussion of the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Thank you, Council.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Give everyone a minute to switch over. Well, the next matter is the Memorandum of Understanding between the FEC and the Department of Justice and the accompanying Federal Register Notice. So let me start off by saying that this is a pretty big moment for our agency. Our current MOU with DOJ has not been updated since 1977, and it is important that we do all we can to strengthen this interagency relationship. Getting to this point took a lot of great work from a lot of great people. I first truly appreciate the efforts of Vice Chairman Cooksey and his staff and Commissioner Weintraub and her staff for their thoughtful and collaborative work that has gotten us to this point. And I want to recognize the FEC staff for this hard work to get this done. Those leading this effort are Lisa Stevenson, Charles Kitcher, Larry Calvert, Peter Blumberg, CJ Pavia, Jin Lee, Justine DiGiovanni, Richard Weiss, Nevin Stepanovich, Bob Knopp, Evan Christopher, Jessica Selenkoff, Greg Baker, Christine McLaren, Steve Hajar, and Kevin Dealey. And from the Department of Justice, I'd like to thank Assistant Attorney General Kenneth Polite, Robert Heberl, Sean Lorraine, and other DOJ staff who have supported these efforts. And I look forward to a strong and collaborative relationship moving forward. So thank you, everybody. It is nice when we get to acknowledge everybody for their really hard work. This is a good day for that. And with that, I'm going to pass it on to Mr. Kitcher and Mr. Stepanovich. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, especially for those very kind words to all the people who contributed to this effort. As you know, before you is a memorandum of understanding between the Commission and the Department of Justice. Also before you is a draft notice that would publish the text of the Memorandum of Understanding in the Federal Register. As recited in the document itself, the purpose of the MOU is to promote the enforcement of the federal campaign finance laws and to establish guidelines for the Commission and the Department to engage in parallel proceedings and share information in appropriate circumstances and otherwise properly advance missions of both agencies, subject to all relevant legal and ethical constraints and informed by the mutual respect and independence of each agency. As the chair alluded to earlier, the Commission and the Department of Justice entered into a MOU in December of 1977. The text of that document was published in the Federal Register in February of 1978. And today, some 45 years later, the Office of General Counsel is very pleased to recommend that the Commission approve this new MOU to be signed by the Acting General Counsel, as well as the notice to be signed under the signature of Chair Lindenbaum. We're available to answer any questions. We recommend that any questions about the notice come to Mr. Stepanovic and his team, and any questions about the MOU be directed to Ms. Stevenson and myself. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Stevenson, Mr. Stepanovic, Mr. Kitcher, and the chair for bringing this. I agree with the chair. This is a big deal. This is a big event, I think, for the agency. As people have already said, the last MOU dates back to 1977. It is badly out of date. It doesn't, there's very little resemblance, I'll say, to what our agency's current dynamic has been with the Department of Justice. And in fact, the Department of Justice took the position over 20 years ago, I think, that the MOU itself is inoperable. And so the commission has been working for the last 20 years to try to get to an agreement with the department on a new MOU that better reflects our relationship. I believe attempts were made in 2003, in 2007, in 2012 to get to an agreement, and the two agencies were unable to do so. But I think today is different, and maybe that today it's finally arrived. So with this new commission, as the chair said, I was working with Commissioner Weintraub on a sort of select subcommittee with our staff and with the leadership of the criminal division to try to work on a new MOU. And I'm very happy and proud to have done that. And I'm going to support the MOU, and I'm going to explain why. And I think there are three particular features that were important to me that I want to highlight that I think make this a document worth supporting. The first is that I think this document is serving a very important transparency function. As I said, the old MOU does not really reflect the current state of affairs. And so to a large extent, what this new MOU is doing is not so much changing the dynamic between the FEC and DOJ, but it's actually codifying what's already been going on. And that serves an important transparency function, important notice function to the regulated community. So now everyone will be informed, everyone will be on notice about the extent to which the commission and the Department of Justice are cooperating and assisting each other in the enforcement of campaign finance laws. And I think that's a big improvement to our transparency mission and to the notice the regulated community has. The third thing that was very important to me in drafting this MOU is that I think the MOU very critically treats our agency and the Department of Justice as peers. It preserves all of the commission's prerogatives, the discretion of commissioners to decide when and how and under what circumstances we do cooperate or may not cooperate with the department. And it preserves the interests that both agencies have in pursuing their own jurisdiction and the enforcement of their either civil or criminal jurisdiction over campaign finance law. And so I'm really happy with the degree of independence that the FEC has retained and the authority that the commissioners are retaining in how this MOU is operated. The last thing I think is important is that I think the MOU it serves two important but dual purposes. The first is that it's going to make a big difference in the enforcement of campaign finance laws against what I would call the worst of the worst. The criminal, very serious, very aggravated violations, knowing and willful violations of campaign finance law that I think everyone would agree deserve criminal investigation and criminal prosecution. At the same time, the MOU also acknowledges, importantly, the risks and the problems and the constitutional dangers of the over-criminalization of campaign finance law. And it's very important to me that this MOU retains the acknowledgement from the 1977 MOU that it's really only the most aggravated and serious and substantial campaign finance violations that are appropriate for criminal prosecution, and that other violations are better and are better suited to civil enforcement. And I think that's a very important acknowledgement that both the department and the FEC are making through this MOU. So I want to thank Commissioner Weintraub for all the work we did with this. I really want to thank Charles Kitcher, who, look back, first emailed me about this about 2 years ago, and we exchanged some outlines of what I thought an MOU needed to say or would need to say. I certainly want to thank all the other staff that the chair mentioned, and Assistant Attorney General Paul Eat, and those in the criminal division. And so, you know, for all those reasons, I'm very excited to support this MOU today. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner Traynor? Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to thank Commissioners Cooksey and Weintraub for taking on the task of negotiating this memorandum with the Department of Justice. And I know that was not an easy task and one that took considerable time. That said, I'd like to take a few minutes to outline for my colleagues and the American people what a dark day I believe this to be for our republic. Not since the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1789 has there been a more grievous affront to the First Amendment than what we have before us today. This memorandum of understanding is harmful to the free public discourse of ideas and the transparency mission of this agency in four significant ways. First, there's no statutory authority for the agency to enter into such an information sharing agreement with another executive branch agency. Second, this memorandum will significantly, and I believe irreparably, harm the level of candor between the entities that are regulated by the Federal Election Campaign Act and this agency. Third, I believe there are significant constitutional concerns that are implicated in this type of memorandum. And finally, as a matter of public policy, this memorandum of understanding is just another example of the recent move to criminalize the participation of the American people in the necessary open exchange of ideas, which is the foundation of our political system. As a threshold matter, we must always look to our limited statutory jurisdiction when we undertake any action, especially when it involves this independent agency sharing information and authority with an agency that is completely under the control of the chief executive. I firmly believe that the only statutory authority that this agency possesses to share information with the Department of Justice is found in 52 USC 30109A5C, wherein it states that, quote, if the commission by an affirmative vote of four of its members determines that there is probable cause to believe that a knowing and willful violation of FECA has occurred or is about to occur, it may refer such apparent violations to the Attorney General, end quote. Such probable cause findings, as you know, come towards the end of the administrative enforcement proceedings. Moreover, when the commission pauses an enforcement matter at the request of the Department of Justice, criminal defendants are denied access to certain statutory provisions that exist in FECA. Because in any criminal action brought for violations of FECA, a defendant may evidence their lack of knowledge or intent to commit the alleged violation by introducing as evidence a conciliation agreement entered into with the FEC. And the court, when assessing a penalty for such criminal actions, must consider the existence of a conciliation agreement. Unfortunately, the memorandum before us would allow the Department of Justice access to information before the commission has completed an administrative prosecution, could cut off access to conciliation agreement defenses and the controlling sentencing guidelines. Therefore, without specific statutory authority to enter into these type of agreements, we should stay within the scope of FECA and what it currently allows and the protections that are provided therein for those facing criminal prosecutions. Second, candor. Candor between the candidates, campaigns, committees, and other entities that we regulate is critical to the commission's mission of encouraging voluntary compliance with the law and providing transparency in campaign financing to the American people. For example, when the Reports Analysis Division makes a request to a committee for more information to clarify a contribution or expenditure, we rely almost exclusively on the representations of that committee to help us clarify the public record. Moreover, those same committees rely upon our staff to be helpful when they cannot understand the rules and regulations that we have put in place. Now, as this memorandum envisions, those requests for additional information and the act of calling for assistance with our onerous regulations will be subject to disclosure to the Department of Justice at their request. How can we expect the regulated community to be forthright with us or seek our assistance when such actions can be used as the basis for criminal investigations? We cannot, and more importantly, we should not. Third, I believe there are constitutional infirmities with the information sharing arrangement espoused by the Memorandum of Understanding. The different forms used by the commission are woefully lacking in notice to those who complete those forms that such information may be shared with the Department of Justice to aid in the investigation of any crimes that they may commit while they're completing those forms. Callers to the Reports Analysis Division are given no notice that our staff will be memorializing their conversations in notes to call in notes of the call, which may at a future date be turned over to the Department of Justice, which may seek to use them as evidence of intent in criminal prosecutions. Additionally, this memorandum would allow for the sharing of information and investigative materials used by the staff in the prosecution of matters under review by the commission, and little, if any, disclosure of how that information will be transmitted to law enforcement is given in this process. All that is to say, there are Fifth and Sixth Amendment issues that are lurking within the memorandum's information sharing. Unfortunately, our council has been unable to provide an assessment of any liability that the commission might face should such constitutional claims arrive. We, as a commission, should be concerned with the upholding of our oaths to defend the Constitution by not potentially jeopardizing the rights of those who are brought under our jurisdiction. Finally, I'm concerned that this memorandum only exacerbates the growing trend in America to criminalize the participation of Americans in the political process. We have seen campaign finance reports used as a weapon to go after donors to candidates and causes, both criminally and civilly. The prosecutions create a chilling effect on the First Amendment rights of all citizens. We've seen the rise of calls for criminal prosecutions of political opponents. Over and above those government prosecutions, we see third-party groups using the complaint process of this agency to get press headlines that necessarily force criminal investigations. Those groups are looking to obtain the imprimatur of an FEC investigation as a means for calling forth a criminal witch hunt. Frankly, those groups have little concern for the administrative fines that could be imposed by the commission. In fact, over the past 5 years, the agency has been asked to abate our administrative proceedings approximately 40 times to allow the Department of Justice to pursue various investigations within their criminal jurisdiction. If this memorandum takes effect, the commission will continue to be enticed by the Department of Justice to stall investigating complaints while matters are battered around the DOJ. The campaign finance system will continue to be used to hunt down those who we disagree with politically, and the agency itself will continue to be a tool of those looking to harm their political and ideological opponents. Based on what I've laid out here, I will not be able to support this memorandum of understanding with the Department of Justice. It is my firm resolve that this memorandum is without statutory authority, inhibits a necessary level of candor for our system to function properly, has serious constitutional implications, and does nothing to quell the criminalization of political participation we are experiencing today. In fact, at least the people had fair notice of the criminal political acts under the Alien and Sedition Acts. Here, they will be required to comb through the Federal Register or our website to see exactly how we are going to share their information about their political activities with federal law enforcement. One can question whether at least having a written agreement with the Department of Justice in place is an improvement over the commission's recent practice of considering these requests for abatement and documents in a black box. But unfortunately, the answer to that question is largely rendered moot by the defects in this new agreement. Accordingly, I plan to vote against the adoption of the Memorandum of Understanding. And Madam Chair, at the appropriate time, I would ask unanimous consent of my colleagues to have these remarks that I've made reduced to writing and placed in the minutes of the meeting. Thank you.
I think we might as well handle that now. Colleagues, do we have unanimous consent?
Yes.
We have unanimous consent.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you for the statement, Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to supporting the adoption of this memorandum of understanding, which has taken a lot of people a long time to negotiate, and I think the agreement is a good one. I appreciate everybody's compliments, but I really cannot take a lot of credit for it, much as I would like to. I was happy to work with my colleague, the vice chairman, on our little ad hoc subcommittee on this, but and I very much appreciate his engagement and his work on this. But I really have to give most of the credit to the staff, Mr. Kitcher and his staff in particular, who really did do the bulk of the work here, and very good work it was. And I also want to thank, I don't want to leave the impression that it was just the vice chairman and me who were engaged in this. The chair has been enthusiastically pushing us forward this year, as did the previous chair, Commissioner Dickerson, and the chair before that, Commissioner Broussard. I think most of my colleagues have been very engaged in this process and have been supportive of it. We are charged with civil enforcement of a body of laws. The Justice Department is charged with criminal enforcement of the same body of laws. And I think our ability to work together will enhance both of us in our in the discharge of our duties under the law and under the Constitution. And I'm really pleased with many features of this agreement. Of course, you know, I'm sure there will be, you know, times when we get into the details of particular matters where we'll have to work things out as we go. But I want to echo one of the important points that the vice chairman made, and that is that the Department of Justice has throughout these negotiations treated us as a peer. And that has not always been the case. I can tell you that, you know, there are various reasons why negotiations have faltered in the past. I don't want to say it was all one-sided. You know, there were things that were going on at the commission that made it harder to get to agreement in the past. But I think one key distinction this go-round that helped make this happen is there was a real commitment on the part of high-level people of the Department of Justice to get this deal done and to work with us in a fair way to accomplish that. The vice chairman and I had a meeting last year with some of the senior leaders on this project at DOJ, particularly AAG Ken Polite, and that was at their request. They asked to meet with commissioners, and I cannot recall that having happened before. And Rob Heberle, Sean Mulrine, Richard Pilger, who is now retired. You know, there are so many people at DOJ who were involved in the drafting and in the thoughts that went into this. And I really want to give the DOJ team a lot of credit for their interest and the respectful way they treated us. And, you know, we are a small agency with, you know, a fraction of their staff and resources. And I really appreciated the, as I said, the peer relationship that they seem to be encouraging and that I think will ultimately benefit the American people in helping us, both agencies, to better enforce the laws. I think the American people want to see laws fairly and effectively enforced. And I think we can work together better to do that. And I think that we will. And this is, I believe, is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Going forward. Sorry, it's one of my favorite movies. So again, with great thanks to everyone at the table and particularly our excellent staff for their excellent work on this, I look forward to supporting these documents. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Colleagues, any further discussion?
Madam Chair, briefly, and I'm not going to repeat everything that's been said. Excellent work to the staff. Mr. Kitcher, you deserve all the praise you've been receiving. You know, this has been a bipartisan priority going back to, you know, at least to Chair Broussard. And I'm grateful to my colleagues for getting across the finish line. I think it's a big deal, not merely because of the merits, but because this is another data point of the ability of the commission to accomplish things that may not have been obvious a few years ago. And I'm personally very proud of that. It's a pleasure to work with people who are committed to finding common ground where we can. I did have, you know, one quick comment on the merits. You know, not going to leave everyone in suspense. I do plan to vote for this. I suspect it'll be adopted. But the there's one aspect of this that I think bears note. And the vice chairman already said this, but I want to emphasize it. You know, this sets up the relationship between us and a sister agency. You know, it's been noted that DOJ is a sister agency. I've been known to quip that they may be true, but they treat us as a much younger sibling. And you know, this is an effort to sort of regularize that, but it doesn't change the statutory discretion and obligations the commission has to make case-by-case determinations. And so, you know, I share a number of the concerns that Commissioner Traynor has raised. I think I can think of worse First Amendment violations since the Alien and Sedition Acts, including the Federal Election Campaign Act before it was modified in the Buckley versus Valeo decision, by the way. But The concern about the ways in which the commission abates enforcement matters are real and legitimate. But of course, that is something that we have some control over. You know, the Department of Justice can request abatement. We grant it. The Department of Justice can request documents. Recommendations are made, but that is a decision made by the agency on a case-by-case basis and by votes of the commission. And so, you know, respectfully, I do think there is merit to that concern, but I think it is an iterative process that will have to be dealt with case by case over time in the tried and true manner of the common law. And I have a great deal of faith that this crop of commissioners will be able to put some ballast into that ship. So with my thanks again to my colleagues, I look forward to bringing our relationship with the Department of Justice forward almost a half century.
Commissioner Broussard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will close this out with thanking my colleagues and adopting much of what all of my colleagues have said today. But I think one of the things that I want to highlight is what we have just heard is that we've all used phrases that we like. So I will say it is a reminder of a new day at the FEC, in the sense that we are working together bipartisan to get things accomplished. But I think the most important comment to close this out is to thank DOJ and to thank our staff. Mr. Kitcher sitting next to me, all the hours that were put in over the course of the last couple of years that may have felt that at times that it might not come to the result that we are today. So kudos to you and your team. The names have been called out, but it never hurts to announce it again and again. Your work is greatly appreciated, and this will accomplish many positive things going forward for the agency. So thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Stevenson.
Okay, wonderful. Was that any motions? Ms. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to the Memorandum of Understanding between the Commission and the Department of Justice and accompanying Federal Register notice, I move approval of agenda document number 23-08-A.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion passes. The motion passes by a vote of 5-1 with the Vice Chair, Commissioner Dickerson, Weintraub, and Broussard, and myself in favor, and Commissioner Traynor opposed. Thank you all. I'm excited to sign this. And
wonderful. Lisa signs it.
I get to sign the Federal Register notice.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. All right, moving on to the final element of our exciting and meaty agenda today is the Press Office Acknowledgement of Complaints Memorandum from Commissioner Dickerson. I'll give everyone a moment to get settled. And with that, I will pass this on to Commissioner Dickerson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really, really hate going after something like that, but the chair sets the agenda. So this policy implements a legal recommendation of our Office of General Counsel from 2006. It's intended and as a ministerial action to take up and resolve a question that appears to have fallen through the cracks for nearly 17 years. It should not reflect on the press office, which has been diligently following its own policy in the absence of commission guidance. The commission has waived its privileges with regard to OGC's 2006 memorandum, which is available on our website. And that allows the public, I think, a window into our reasons for considering this policy and I hope taking it up. I want to highlight, though, 2 points. First, as the memorandum notes, this policy does not affect the ability of complainants to discuss their complaints with the public and the press. Existing advisory opinions already protect that conduct. And I would add personally that a contrary rule would raise significant constitutional difficulties. Obviously, complainants publicly discussing their own complaints are engaged in First Amendment protected speech. I would add that so is criticism of this commission and its members, even when uninformed, unflattering, and hyperbolic. As a matter of constitutional avoidance, I do not believe our confidentiality rules could prohibit complainants from engaging in these public discussions and advocacy, even in the absence of any on-point advisory opinion, and I would expect to vote accordingly in any enforcement action. Second, as the memorandum also emphasizes, confidentiality is a protection for respondents. There are policy arguments for why a given respondent may prefer that we confirm the filing of a complaint. These arguments are, in my view, foreclosed by the regulation. More importantly, they are also paternalistic because the confidentiality protections are entirely in respondents' hands. If particular respondents wish the commission to confirm or deny the filing of a complaint, they need merely waive their confidentiality rights. With that introduction, Madam Chair, and with deference to my colleagues and their questions, I'm prepared to offer a motion at the appropriate time.
Thank you. Colleagues, any discussion? Question? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to Commissioner Dickerson for bringing this before the commission. And I particularly appreciate his comments about the First Amendment rights of complainants, because that I have to say was my number one concern. And even having heard Commissioner Dickinson's comments, I have to say I still have some concern about this regulation, which I think the regulation frankly goes beyond the statute. It doesn't mention complaints, mentions notifications, doesn't mention complaints. I think in expanding on that, on what's in the statute, may be ill-advised, but it is a regulation that is lawfully promulgated and on our books. So the question is, what is it? What is the best reading of that? What does it actually mean when the regulation says no complaint filed with the commission may be made, there's an ellipsis in there, shall be made public by the commission or by any person or entity without the written consent of the respondent. That seems like a very broad statement. And as I said, I'm somewhat, I'm happy to hear Commissioner Dickerson say that he also thinks there would be First Amendment concerns if we tried to actually enforce that against a complainant. The right to criticize the government, the right to file complaints against people who are in office is really at the heart of the First Amendment. So, if we were to try to limit that some way, I think that really would be constitutionally infirm. But I do worry that that's what the regulation kind of says. So I think the wording of the regulation is problematic. Having said that, again, I go back to what does it mean to say that no one may make public a complaint filed with the commission? Well, the complaint is a document. It's a series of words on pages that have meaning and content. And I'm not ultimately convinced. I thought about this long and hard. But, I'm not ultimately convinced that it is making the complaint public to state whether the complaint has or has not been filed. And I think that there are solid reasons why the content should remain confidential, but it's less clear to me from a transparency standpoint that it is a good policy to say that the existence of the complaint and whether it has been filed is something that is either protected by this regulation or is a good idea to hold back from the public. I think that, that there's been a press policy dating back to pretty much the origins of the commission. And it was not something that the press office made up. It was something that commissioners had input into well before my time, that it was appropriate to either confirm or deny the existence of a complaint if they usually comes up with a reporter asking, so-and-so says they filed a complaint against this other person, is that true? If we are in a position to confirm or deny that, we can also ward off rumor mongering and conspiracy theories by people who say they filed a complaint, but actually did not go through the effort of filing a complaint or did not have a basis for jumping through all the hoops. They weren't willing to get it notarized and sign the complaint, but they just want to cause trouble for someone out there. I think it's an interesting legal question that I was thinking about this morning. If there isn't actually a complaint, and therefore there isn't actually a respondent, can the respondent waive confidentiality over when they're not indeed a respondent? I think that would be an unfortunate interpretation to say you can only waive confidentiality over an actual complaint and not over a fraudulent claim of a complaint that doesn't even exist. But I think that the transparency mission of the commission has to be balanced against the confidentiality obligations of the commission under the statute. Statute, as I said, doesn't touch this. It's just a question of regulation. But I think that in my own view, the better reading of the regulation is that it covers the contents, the complaint itself, the documents, the contents of it, not the fact of whether it has been filed or not. So as I said, I appreciate Commissioner Dickinson's efforts, and I thought long and hard about this, but I'm definitely not going to be able to take this point.
Any further discussion?
Well, let me turn to parliamentarian. I think it'd be more appropriate to move the instruction to the press office than to move the agenda document. Would you agree?
Yes.
Thank you. Laconic as ever, sir. In that case, I move that the commission direct that the press office decline to confirm or deny the filing of any complaint in response to future inquiries.
Any second the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion passes by a vote of 4-2 with the vice chair, Commissioner Dickerson, Commissioner Traynor, and myself in favor, Commissioner Weintraub and Broussard opposed. That, Mr. Staff Director, are there any management or administrative matters that need to be discussed?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
Wonderful. Well, this concludes our open agenda. Thank you all for a great meeting today, and we stand adjourned.
Stand by.